The following podcast is brought to you by Radio Southland and New Zealand On Air. Radio Southland is a community access media station based in Invercargill, New Zealand. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, radiosouthland.org.nz, for our contact details.
Hey, welcome to Gaslight Gospel. You're listening to the raw truth about abusers, control, and the games they play. Here, we strip away the lies, crush the myths, and show you exactly when it's time to run. No fluff, no sugarcoating, just facts that could save your life. Gaslight Gospel. Reveal, resist, run. You're listening to Gaslight Gospel with Cece, one half of JRCC from Flippin' Tables. I live more than a decade inside it. The charm, the chokehold of emotional abuse, the sexual coercion dressed up as love, the financial strangle that made freedom feel expensive. I didn't have the words back then. I just called it a rough patch, his temper, even my fault. It wasn't until I started talking, out loud, shaky, but out loud, that the fog thinned and the naming began. Once you name it, you can fight it. I'm here because I know the trap from the inside. And I'm done being quiet. If any of this sounds like you, like your life, you're not crazy and you're not alone. This is your space now. Welcome to Gaslight Gospel with Cece. This is part 3 of the abuser mythology and the lies that keep him untouchable. By now you've seen how myths about abuse don't just protect the abuser. They keep you questioning your own reality. These aren't harmless misunderstandings that you can shrug off. They're weapons and shields. They're so finely tuned that they're tools built to deflect accountability, redirect suspicion, and keep the cycle turning in his favor. Every myth has its purpose. Some are designed to make outsiders pity him so they'll see you as overreacting or unstable. Others exist to make you blame yourself, convincing you that if you could just love him better, understand him more, or support him through his struggles, the abuse would just stop. Still, others paint him as helpless, a man ruled by his temper, his trauma, his background, his job, his drinking, and all of these designed to distract from the truth that abuse is a choice. And the most dangerous myths are the ones that sound almost reasonable. They don't scream lies from a distance. They have just enough truth in them to make you pause. They use the language of pop psychology, the familiarity of cultural stereotypes, and the authority of well-meaning professionals who've been misled themselves. Abusers don't just fool victims. They fool police officers, counselors, and yes, even family court judges. And that's why this section matters. Here, we're going to dismantle some of the most stubborn, slippery myths, the one that can even make a seasoned advocate doubt what they know. From the idea that all abusers secretly hate women, to the belief that a better job, anger management, or sobriety will transform him. These myths are bricks in a carefully constructed wall. A wall that keeps the truth out, but keeps you in, and yet keeps him untouchable. It's time to pull out those bricks, one by one, until there's nothing left for him to hide behind. So stay tuned for myth number 9. He hates women. Welcome back to Gaslight Gospel. And we're breaking down the myths that abusers have. And now we're moving on to myth number 9. He hates women. It's easy to picture an abusive man as a snarling misogynist who can't stand the sight of women. That's the stereotype. A man spitting contempt at any woman who crosses his path. And yes, those men exist. But here's the twist. Most abusers don't hate women at all. In fact, many of them can be warm, charming, and respectful to certain women in their lives. They'll dote on their mums, they'll defend their sisters, they'll banter with the woman in the cafe who gets their coffee order right. Some can work under a female boss without ever raising their voice. They might even sing her praises at work functions. To the outside world, these men don't look like women haters. They look like good guys who get along just fine with the opposite sex. The problem isn't universal hatred, it's entitlement. It's the belief that the women they choose to be close to, especially romantic partners, should revolve around them. They can respect a woman in one context while believing that their partner at home owes them obedience and constant emotional service. It's not about gender hatred. It's about control in the intimate sense. A woman once told me, I couldn't convince anyone he was abusive because they'd all see him helping his mum through cancer treatment. They thought that proved he couldn't possibly be what I was describing. But in her home, the same man would belittle her for buying the wrong type of milk interrogate her for hours about who she'd spoken to that day, and punch holes in the wall where her head had been seconds earlier. Another woman told me her partner was the darling of their social circle, the guy everyone wanted at the barbecue because he made people laugh, yet he kept her isolated from her own family and locked her out of their bank accounts. To his mates, he was the most likable guy they knew. To her, he was a prison warden with a wedding ring. This myth sticks because it's easier for outsiders to imagine that abuse is fueled by some deep unhealed wound from a woman from his past. That way, there's a neat cause. And if there's a cause, there's hope for a cure. But the research is clear. Having a bad relationship with his mother doesn't create an abuser, and having a good one doesn't prevent it. In fact, many abusive men will use good relationships with certain women as proof that they're not abusive. If I really hated women, would I treat my mum or my sister like gold? Here's the truth survivors know in their bones. He doesn't have to hate all women to hurt you. He just has to believe that you are his to shape, manage, and control. And some myths survive because they sound like compassion. They frame the abuser not as a threat, but as a wounded child, someone terrified of losing love or letting anyone close. It's a softer story, one that makes his cruelty seem like a defense mechanism instead of a choice. And if you believe it, you might feel sorry for him. And when you feel sorry for someone, it becomes harder to hold them accountable. But here's the danger. When we label abuse as fear of intimacy or fear of abandonment, we turn that person being harmed into the caretaker of the harm doer. It flips the script so completely that you might end up feeling like you are the one who's letting him down. So stay tuned for myth number 10. He's afraid of intimacy and or abandonment. Welcome back to Gaslight Gospel. This is Cece. We're moving on to myth number 10, where the abuser is considered to be frightened of intimacy or abandonment. This myth shows up in quiet, almost sympathetic tones. Oh, he just pushes you away before you can leave him. Or he's terrified of being abandoned, and that's why he's so clingy. To someone on the outside, it explains the jealousy, the checking of your phone, the controlling who you see. To someone on the inside, it is the rope that keeps you tied to him. Because if you leave, aren't you just confirming his worst fears? Here's the truth. Fear of abandonment doesn't make someone track your movements, smash your phone, or threaten to ruin your life. If it did, the world would be in chaos. Millions of people are afraid of losing their partner. They beg, they cry, they grieve, but they don't terrorize. They don't stalk. They don't punish. I knew a woman who said her partner would spiral every time she mentioned spending a night at her sister's. He'd start with, "Oh, I'll miss you," then move to, "Why would you leave me?" and end with, "If you go, don't bother coming back." So she stayed home more and more, not because she wanted to, but because of the fact that she was afraid of what he'd do if she didn't. That's not fear of abandonment. That's using abandonment as a weapon. The fear of intimacy, that particular theory doesn't hold up either. If he truly feared closeness, the abuse would happen when you were emotionally connected, not when you were pulling away. But most survivors know the worst explosions often come after days or weeks of tension, not in the middle of a tender moment. In some relationships, there are no tender moments to interrupt. He keeps his distance on purpose, then still finds reasons to attack her. One woman from a rural community said that her husband barely spoke to her for months at a time. No closeness, no affection, no intimacy. Yet the verbal assaults were daily. When she told a counselor this, the counselor said, "Maybe he's just afraid of letting you in." She remembers thinking, "Well, if he was afraid of letting me in, why does he seem so comfortable when he's shoving me down?" It's easy to believe these myths because they make abuse sound like something you can fix. That if you love him enough, reassure him enough, or promise you'll never leave, he'll stop hurting you. But intimacy and abandonment aren't the root cause of abuse. Entitlement and control is. He's not afraid of closeness. Remember, he's afraid of losing control. So let's unravel the intimacy myth. The fear of intimacy is a seductive story because it wraps abuse in something that feels like love. It reframes cruelty as self-protection. You start thinking, "He's not trying to hurt me. He's just scared of getting too close." Suddenly, instead of asking why he's hurting you, you're asking what you can do to make him feel safe. And that's exactly how the trap starts. Survivors often say they clung to his explanation because it offered hope. If the abuse was rooted in fear, then maybe tenderness could fix it. Maybe if you just prove that you'd never leave, he'd stop lashing out. It's a comforting equation. But it's completely false. Here's why. Fear of intimacy would make someone avoid closeness. Abuse isn't avoidance, it's invasion. He's stepping into your space without permission, physically, emotionally, sexually, financially, and rearranging the furniture in your life to suit himself. It's not fear of you getting too close. It's fear of you getting far enough away to see the truth. I remember a woman who said her partner wasn't used to love, that he'd never had a stable home. So when she hugged him, he'd go stiff. She thought his coldness was proof of his fear. But that same man had no problem being warm and charismatic at parties, laughing with strangers, or enjoying time at the pub. The problem wasn't closeness. The problem with closeness was that she had to now be treated as an equal. And he didn't want to do that. Abusive men often play along to this myth because it softens their image. Oh, I'm not just good at relationships, or I've got trust issues. It makes them sound damaged instead of dangerous. It also turns the person they're harming into the emotional mechanic, the one who has to keep fixing the engine that keeps breaking down. But in reality, there is nothing broken about his ability to connect. He just doesn't value connection unless it keeps him in control. And here's the final tale. Fear of intimacy doesn't make someone punish you. It doesn't make them threaten your safety or your stability when you get too close to the truth. That's a strategy. And that's not fear of intimacy. It's a calculated way to keep you in reach and also under control. By now, you might be seeing the pattern. These myths are designed to make you the caretaker. If he's afraid of intimacy, you'll work harder to make him feel safe. If he's supposedly terrified of abandonment, you'll make yourself smaller so he never feels threatened. And the next one, it's the most exhausting of all. The idea that he just hates himself and he needs you to hold him together. So let's go on to myth number 11. He has low self-esteem. Welcome back to Gaslight Gospel. This is Cece. So, myth 11, he has low self-esteem. This one's a masterstroke because it flips the power dynamic on its head. Suddenly, he's not the one crushing you. He's the fragile one. He's the one who needs protecting. And you're told, directly or indirectly, that it's your job to fill the cracks so that he doesn't shatter. I've known women who were bone tired from years of this emotional triage. They learned his moods like a second language. They could read the set of his jaw, the way he dropped the keys on the bench, the sharpness in his hello. Also, they could get ahead of the storm, where they thought, I just help him keep feeling good about himself. Maybe tonight will be calm. But here's the truth. You can't praise someone into becoming non-abusive. You can't love someone into treating you with respect. You can pour every bit of affirmation into him. Tell him he's a good man, tell him he's smart, tell him you believe in him. And the next day, he'll still find a way to remind you where the power sits. And it's not just about him feeling bad about himself. Many abusive men have no trouble feeling good when it suits them. They can enjoy a barbecue, crack jokes in the office, win awards, soak up admiration. So if low self-esteem was the real issue, you'd see them lashing out at everyone, not just at you when the front door shuts. I knew a woman whose partner was a local sports hero. He thrived on the praise of fans and teammates, never missed a chance to shake hands or pose for photos. But at home, she walked on eggshells. If she didn't gush over his latest game or agree with his opinion about a coach, the coldness would set him. And if she called him out for the silent treatment, he'd say, "Oh, I just need you to believe in me." The truth? He already believed in himself. He just wanted her unquestioning devotion as proof of her place beneath him. The low self-esteem myth is so dangerous because it rewards abuse with more care, more attention, and more submission. You end up training yourself to meet his emotional needs at the expense of your own safety and well-being. It's like pouring water into a bucket with no bottom. Nothing you do will ever be good enough. Because the point isn't to heal him. The point is to keep you in the role of provider while he is in the role of taker. And here's the kicker. When you stop feeding his ego, that's when the backlash starts. The coldness, the criticism, the accusations that you've changed or that you don't care anymore. That's not low self-esteem talking. That's entitlement. That's a man who believes your role is to keep him elevated, even if it costs you everything. And then if the low self-esteem myth is the bait, the ego trap is the hook. Once you've been convinced he's fragile, you start pouring yourself into keeping him whole. And somewhere along the way, that stops becoming an occasional act of kindness and then becomes your full-time job. Except it's a job with no pay, No rest days and no possibility of promotion. And here's the thing, an abusive man's ego is not like a plant you can nurture until it's healthy and strong. It's more like a furnace that runs on, It's more like a furnace that runs on fuel. And the only fuel it accepts is your time, attention, and emotional labor. And when you stop shoveling it in, he doesn't think maybe I should stoke my own fire. He thinks, why has she stopped serving me? Survivors talk about the mental gymnastics they've done to keep the peace. Rehearsing compliments before he gets home, faking enthusiasm for his stories, clapping for his small wins. And all for what? A brief window of calm before the next storm rolls in. Because the trap is, the more you feed his ego, the more he expects it. What felt like helping at the start becomes the baseline that he measures you against. One woman described it perfectly. It's like I was a cheerleader for a team that never played fair. I cheer when they scored, I cheer when they fouled, and if I ever stopped cheering, even for a second, I got blamed for the loss. The ego trap also works in reverse. When he's on a high after a big work win, praise from mates, or even just a good gym session, you might think, great, he's in a great mood, so I'm safe tonight. But sometimes that inflated ego can make things worse. Now he feels untouchable, more entitled, more convinced that he deserves whatever he wants, exactly when he wants it and how he wants it. And here's the ugly twist. He doesn't have to feel bad about himself to treat you badly. He can be at the peak of his confidence and still cut you down. Because the point isn't to fix how he feels. It's to keep you in a position of proving your loyalty. And once you see this trap for what it is, you'll start to notice the patterns. The praise isn't mutual. The care isn't mutual. It's one way. And you're holding it. And it all depends on you. So by now, you've already noticed a running theme. These myths take something that could happen to anyone, a bad day, bruised ego, stressful job, and it's being used as a hall pass for abuse. And the next one is the oldest trick in the book. It goes like this. He's under so much pressure at work, his boss rides him constantly. He just needs somewhere to let it out. So let's go on to myth number 12. Stay tuned for his boss abuses him, so he takes it out on the family. Hey, welcome back to Gaslight Gospel with Cece. We're talking about the abusers and the mythology. And if you want to know more, go onto our website, www.flippintables.co.nz, and buy our book, Gaslight Gospel. All right, so we're moving on to the next myth, the oldest one in the book, myth 12. His boss treats him badly, so he takes it out on the family. It's the kick the cat theory of abuse, except in this story, the cat is you. The idea sounds almost logical. A man gets pushed around by someone who has more power, so he comes home and reclaims his power by pushing someone else around. People picture a miserable man, shoulders hunched, trudging home after being humiliated at work, only to bark orders or throw insults once he walks through the door. And yes, there are people who vent their stress on those closest to them. But when you look closely at the patterns of domestic abuse, that theory collapses. Some of the most dangerous men I've known didn't have a boss to answer to. They were the boss, business owners, CEOs, senior managers. They had power in the workplace and expected the same or more at home. I've heard a man say, I've had to order people around all day. I can't just switch that off when I walk through the door. Now that is not stress, that's entitlement. And here's the thing, I've never seen a man's abuse vanish because his work situation improved. The mean boss is a convenient scapegoat, not a root cause. I've seen men land a cushy new job, double their salary, and still scream at their partners over how the dishwasher was loaded. Real workplace stress doesn't make someone abusive. It might make them quiet, snappy, or withdrawn. But remember that abuse is targeted, deliberate, and patterned. A stressed out non-abusive partner might need space or comfort, but an abusive one uses stress as a license to control. And let's be honest, if he can manage to keep it together in front of his boss, clients, or colleagues, no matter how bad his day is, then he can keep it together to control himself with you. He's simply choosing not to around you. And if you've been following along, you'll notice a pattern. Almost every myth paints the abuser as a man with a skill gap, poor coping mechanisms, unrefined emotional vocabulary, no training in conflict resolution. And the theory goes, teach him to use his words, help him manage stress better, and the abuse will melt away like frost in the sun. And that means we need to go on to myth number 13. He just needs communication or stress management skills. Stay tuned for myth number 13. problem with the skills theory is, here's the uncomfortable truth. Most abusers already know how to communicate. They know how to manage conflict when they want to. They can be charming in job interviews, negotiate calmly with a bank manager, keep their voice steady in front of the police. They can survive a tense boardroom meeting without shouting or throwing things. The skills aren't really missing. They're just selectively applied. The difference isn't ability, it's willingness. And how does this myth hook survivors? For a survivor, this myth is seductive. It makes abuse feel fixable. Like if you can just get him to find that right workshop counselor, or of course, you can then save the relationship. I've known women who've spent years sitting through couples therapy sessions, biting their tongue, nodding along, while their partners learned exactly what to say, to sound accountable, and then went home and carried on as before. One woman told me that her husband became a master at active listening in therapy, nodding, repeating back what she'd said, validating her feelings. But once the session ended, he used those same skills to twist her words more effectively. Communication skills won't dismantle entitlement. Stress management classes won't rewire beliefs about ownership and control. You can give him every tool in the world, but if he doesn't believe that you have the same rights as him to safety, autonomy, and respect, he'll use those tools to manipulate you. An abuser's problem isn't that he can't resolve conflict without abuse, it's that he doesn't want to. Because abuse gets him what he wants faster. So let's go on to the next myth. If you've ever dared to speak openly about abuse, you've heard this one tossed out like a trump card. Well, women can be just as bad. It's a statement that sounds balanced and fair. But in reality, it's a distraction that blurs and protects the men who are actually doing the harm. Myth number 14. There are just as many abusive women as abusive men. Welcome back to Myth 14. There are just as many abusive women as men. Yep, there are women who treat their male partners badly, who belittle them, call them names, or attempt to control them. The harm is real and it should never be excused. But when you look at the patterns, the scale and severity, the pictures change. Where are the men forced into sex, but they don't want to, under the threat of violence? Where are the men fleeing their homes with nothing but the clothes on their back because they fear for their lives? Where are the men hiding in shelters, living in secrecy, cutting ties with friends and family to stay safe? Those cases do exist, and I'm not belittling that. I'm not negating those, but they are a fraction compared to the overwhelming volume of women living in those realities every day. If the rates were equal, truly equal, we'd see men packing out refuges in crisis lines, struggling to cope with the volume. We just don't. Some argue that men don't come forward because they're embarrassed. But shame doesn't just belong to one gender. Women in abusive relationships face enormous humiliation too. Yet we still see millions reporting abuse every year. In today's climate, neighbors, colleagues, bystanders are more likely to call the police when they hear violence. If vast numbers of terrified men were out there, the system would find them. And here's the danger. Abusive men love this myth. It gives them a ready-made victim narrative. They'll say things like, "Sure, I'm stronger, but she's vicious with her mouth. She knows exactly how to hurt me." I once heard a man in a group program compare his wife's verbal criticism to being stabbed in the heart. The same wife he'd literally stabbed in the chest with a knife. These false narratives are designed to minimize violence and muddy the waters and make outsiders unsure who to believe. Now, abuse isn't limited to heterosexual couples. Men can be abused by men and women by women. LGBTQ+ survivors experience many of the same dynamics we've discussed here, often with extra layers of fear, shame, and humiliation of being outed, isolated, or disbelieved. And we're just talking about male-female dynamics here. The imbalance is clear. Men make up the overwhelming majority of abusers. The next myth, number 15, he suffers just as much as his partner. It's quite slippery because it plays into our human instinct for fairness. Now, if both people are hurting, then maybe it's not really abuse. Maybe it's just a toxic relationship or a clash of personalities or two equally wounded people lashing out. And that's why this myth is just as dangerous, because it erases the power imbalance and paints the abuser as a co-victim. So let's move on to myth number 15. He suffers just as much as his partner. Abusers are skilled at presenting themselves as misunderstood, burdened, or broken inside. They'll tell you the fights are just as hard on them as they are on you. They'll see things like, you don't understand how guilty I feel after, it's not easy on me. And if you've ever seen him cry or collapse into shame after an incident, it's easy to believe him. But here's the reality, whatever discomfort he feels fades pretty fast. In counseling groups, I've seen men laugh, chat, and talk sports 10 minutes after describing a violent incident, while their partners, weeks later, are still jumpy if the door closes too quickly. An abuser's life can carry on almost untouched, and that's the unequal fallout. His job remains intact, his health remains stable, his friendships don't evaporate, he can compartmentalize. But for his partner, there's no such separation. Abuse seeps into every corner. She's exhausted, anxious, her physical health declines, and her sense of self erodes. It's like comparing someone who gets wet running through a sprinkler to someone who's been drowning for years. And here's where the emotional sleight of hand happens. Because some abusers weaponize remorse, performing it just enough to keep you hooked. They might sulk for days, blame their mood, and all of that just to get you to comfort them. And in those moments, the spotlight swings off your pain and lands squarely on his. And why is this myth so convenient? Because if he can convince you and everyone else that you're both suffering equally, he sidesteps accountability. And that keeps him in control, and the control's intact while you carry the weight of repairing the relationship. By now you've seen it, how these myths don't just protect him. They wrap around you too. They slide into the way you think, the way you explain the bruises you can't photograph, the way you excuse the jabs that never left a mark. They keep you stuck. They keep you quiet. And worst of all, they keep you believing that you can fix him without it costing him anything. Every story you've heard that he's broken, wounded, scared, stressed, lets him keep the one thing that he'll never volunteer to give up. Control. Because that's the real price here. Not love, not closeness, not even your respect. Just control. These lies work because they're easier to believe than the truth. The truth is sharp-edged. It doesn't leave much room for the comforting idea that he'll wake up one morning, look in the mirror, and decide to change for you. It's more likely he'll wake up, remember what he gets out of treating you this way, and carry on exactly as before, or maybe worse. Think about the patterns. How many times has he lost control with you, but managed to keep it together in front of someone else? How many times has he sworn it's the stress or the argument that you started, only to repeat the same behavior when none of those things were in play? They're not accidents. They're boundaries that he set for himself, that he chooses to ignore when it comes to you. And the hard part to admit is that abuse works for him. It gets him obedience and a home that runs on his rules. It gets him responsibilities he doesn't want and privileges he never earned, and sympathy. And that's why abusers don't hit rock bottom like an addict, because life is fine for him as it is. Next week, we'll look at the tactics that keep you doubting yourself, the traps designed to make leaving seem impossible, and the careful work of dismantling the hold that he's had over you. You've just heard Gaslight Gospel. And if you've caught yourself nodding along, it's because you've seen it or lived it. Want to go deeper? Grab the book, Gaslight Gospel, at www.flippintables.co.nz. In the next episode, we're taking another hard swing at the tactics that they don't want you to spot. If you're in immediate danger, call 111. Until then, stay sharp, stay safe, and remember, reveal, resist, run.
The preceding podcast was brought to you by Radio Southland with the support of New Zealand On Air. Their funding of accessmedia.nz makes these podcasts available. To find similar programs by other stations involved, go online to accessmedia.nz.